Are you a thought leader or just a lousy thought follower? Join Johnny and Big Hungry in The Big Far Out, supported by the Freemasons Foundation.
Well, welcome to BFM, Chantal Grimberg.
Yes.
Have I pronounced that okay?
Yeah, that's right. Chantal Grimberg.
What faculty do you work at or study at Auckland University?
Well, I've just finished my studies. So I was a law student and an arts student, majoring in English and economics and a diploma in Spanish.
Now, I had a quick look through two of your published works.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously one of them was huge in the New Zealand media 10 years ago, the Clayton Weatherston and Sophie Elliott case. It raises a few interesting questions around the effect of extensive media coverage mm-hmm. on some of these trials. And I think we see it all the time now, and especially with social media, there's a lot more sort of knee-jerk reactions and a lot more finger-pointing goes on. Obviously, that case in particular was absolutely horrific. But, I mean, what do you think about the effect of extensive media coverage on New Zealand's political agenda? Do you think it's troublesome or...?
It's literally trial by internet.
I don't know if I'd say it's troublesome. I just think that the media has a certain responsibility to the public in general, because obviously the public is relying on the media for the knowledge on, obviously in this case I was talking about the Weatherston trial, and obviously the media can have a focus that it's going to pursue, and that's it can maybe influence the public as to what they think about certain cases, and that can be sometimes problematic, especially where the case is very controversial. And I guess the flow-on effect in terms of that article I was writing on is that where there's a huge public response, then the political realm can also obviously come into play and respond to what the public is wanting. So in this case, it was... I felt that the concern was that New Zealanders were thinking that perhaps it wasn't the ability to convict offenders like Weatherston, and then there's the issue of if they can't be convicted, it's sort of where's the fairness in play, and how can you, in terms of, it should be the offender who's on trial, not the victim. So in this case, it kind of looks like the victim was on trial, and I think that's where the response came from. And the concern is if there's going to be a repeal of the defence, which was the case here, obviously there were concerns with how the provocation defence operated, but the fact that it was repealed so quickly and there wasn't any legislative response in terms of maybe introducing other partial defences to help battered women or other vulnerable sectors of society was the concern I was worried about in terms of that case. Yeah.
Has much come to pass? Did they repeal that defence, or was it...
Yes. The defence was repealed completely, so it's not available on the statutory books or in the common law, whereas other jurisdictions like in England and Wales, they have abolished, or the defence they seem to recall, and they've introduced other partial defences, so maybe like the partial defence of loss of self-control. Victoria in Australia has also abolished it, but then they revised their self-defence laws so it's more easy for a battered woman to raise that defence. So there were kind of other responses in play, which wasn't the case here in New Zealand.
All right. Very, very interesting. Sure. Would you like to talk about the other paper you've written about the comfort woman in Japan?
Yes.
It's such a crazy story, from my perspective, it's something that I hadn't really maybe come across before. So we're going back to World War II.
Yes, and basically, the Asia-Pacific War.
Yeah, the Japanese have made camps full of women to be used as sex slaves, which has never sort of been redressed or, you know, looked at by any sort of international tribunal?
Mm-hmm.
Or has it even been recognised?
So in the aftermath of World War II and the Asia-Pacific War, obviously a number of international tribunals were established. So the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg was one. And then in terms of like the Asia-Pacific War dealing with those issues, it was the International Military Tribunal for the Far East. And so the focus of that tribunal was mainly on Japan's aggression
mm-hmm.
towards, like, for instance, the United States, and there was the capacity to prosecute the Japanese officials and the emperor in terms of the crimes committed in these sex camps, but that never fully arose because of this focus. And so the Tokyo Women's Tribunal, which was a people's-based tribunal, was really important because it was established, I think, in 2000, from memory, and it had a focus of letting the women tell their stories about, well, not their stories, their testimonies about their time in the camp. So even though the Women's Tribunal couldn't put in place legal sanctions, they were able to obviously have that moral condemnation there. And I think it's important that, as you said, because you obviously weren't aware of this issue, I myself wasn't aware of this issue until I took a master's paper on this topic. And to me, I think if you're ever going to be able to deal with history, it's really important to be able to hear those testimonies. And obviously you can't really always get a true understanding of that history because there's so much that's gone on and there's been like a time lag. But I think the key issue is to be able to hear those stories so that at least there's some attempt to provide some form of justice.
Were those stories written or recorded, or how did that go down?
There was the option for the women to pre-record their testimonies and they could appear in the tribunal itself. So,
how did you hear about this to even decide to do something on it?
Yeah, so as I was saying, I did a master's paper a couple of years ago, and it was on the uncensored history of international law. So we talked about things like the League of Nations, and we talked about the Chagos Islanders, which is another controversial issue, and we also talked about this. And so for me, I felt this was the most compelling topic that I wanted to write on. So it was through that I learnt about this.
Cool.
Big question. What do you think the key things are to advance the position of women in international law? Can you like put that into a nutshell? Is there any way to do that? Like to
a profound answer for.
I think that's a really complex question. I think maybe if I just relate it back again to the tribunal, I felt it was really important here because they focused on the fact that they were an extension of the IMTFE, and they talked about they focused on how these were crimes against humanity. So basically they developed the law in a manner that should have been occurring mm-hmm. back when the original IMTFE did its judgment. So I think that was a good way of developing international law, but in terms of future tribunals, I think maybe it would be important to have more tribunals in the future that are people's based, because obviously the people have a good means of suggesting how law should be developed, and it shouldn't just be a hard application of Westphalian sovereignty and mm-hmm. Just interactions purely between states.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chantal Grimberg, everybody.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much for coming in. It's awesome.
And thanks for your time.
Sweet.
Makes you think, doesn't it? Johnny and Big Hungry in The Big Far Out, supported by the Freemasons Foundation.